right? I get really excited about leveraging sort of this, the hardware and the software to expand global access to care, right? I mean, I'm sure you heard, right? We just most recently had the first transcontinental robotic surgery to remove prostate cancer, performed on a man in Angola by a physician from Advent Health in Florida, right? And the first sort of AI plus remote robotic throat surgery was done in China. So I think we're sort of at the cusp of things to come. And I think what it'll look like in 10-ish years, I think AI will be ubiquitous in healthcare, right? I think the agents and the co-pilots that I was talking about earlier for many of sort of, again, the specific tasks, I think they will be there. And what I hope that means for our country and sort of in general is that these will create then efficiencies in healthcare that'll offset to some degree the sort of ballooning cost of care in this country, right? My hope is that it'll just mean those efficiencies will take us out from this terrible cycle that we've been in of high cost and poor outcomes, right? And then the other thing I think it means for us in the next 10 years is that healthcare will hopefully be really deeply personalized, right? So whether it's the wearables or the RPM tools, or whether it's precision sort of genomics and precision medicine, right? And that's what precision means, right? Is that we've got now sort of enough data to say something very specific, right? And that means that hopefully we're also living in a healthcare paradigm where we're anticipating and understanding prevention a lot more, right? And we're really starting to bend the curve on these healthcare outcomes, right? I think that's where I see, I'm, as you can see, a tech optimist in that sense. So that's where I see things sort of going.
Well, welcome to the podcast of the American College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine. And today it's my pleasure to be interviewing Lida Rashid, who is a physician that, in addition to seeing patients in outpatient medicine and hospital medicine, like myself and hopefully those listening, has found her way not just into the pathway of being involved with AI, but she really has been a leader, especially at the FDA, in making a major impact in determining which AI algorithms are approved for use. And I'm super excited to talk with Lida. Things that we share in common are recently I've done some primary care at the University of Illinois. And throughout my career as a hospitalist, I kept primary care going in terms of resident clinic supervision. But Lida's been very involved in primary care, but more importantly, in hospital medicine. And many of our members in our organization are hospital physicians, and many are in high-level leadership in hospital medicine. So she's done both, and then far before I ever pivoted into AI, she has been involved with digital health and made her way to the FDA. And so, with that basic introduction, I'm just going to ask you, Lida, to tell us first your journey as to how you decided to go into medicine, and then how that eventually led into AI in medicine, in addition to practicing medicine in the way that I have done as well. So tell us the pathway.
No, thank you. And thank you, first of all, so much for having me. This is such a wonderful forum, I think. And I'm glad I was able to find you, Mel, and your podcast, because I really do think more and more of this type of content needs to get out there, especially for clinicians who are otherwise so busy. So again, super big thank you for having me. I started medicine from an early age, probably like many physicians. I wanted to be a doctor, and I knew this is what I wanted to do. But I think for me, what is probably even a more interesting angle is when I started to realize I wanted to do medicine plus maybe something else. And I had some really great medical training at the Oregon Health Sciences University, and one of the early things I got to do as even a med student was actually go back to my home country of Afghanistan. So I was born in Afghanistan, and I came here. My family came here as refugees and sort of grew up here, went to college here. And so that sort of first year after medical school, after medical school had started, I worked with Loma Linda University, which is a university down in Southern California, and they were on a really interesting USAID project in Afghanistan to help strengthen the hospital system. And it was sort of one of the first forays I had into understanding medicine from sort of a 30,000 foot view, and understanding particularly the struggles of low and middle income countries trying to deliver health care. And so when I came back from that trip to Afghanistan the first time around, I sort of knew right off the bat that I wanted to study something like public health, right? Because I felt like, yeah, I knew I was gonna, go and see patients, but I sort of wanted to really think about the systems that, patients operate in. And so I ended up pursuing a Master of Public Health as well at Harvard, and then had another really sort of formative experience while I was at Harvard, where we, as the group of public health students, got together with a group of students at the Harvard Business School. And, we sort of had a mission to try and solve a complicated problem in a low resource setting. So the program was we were, sent to some rural communities in India to try and improve access to primary care in these rural settings, working with one of the large tertiary health systems. And the goal was sort of, try to use public health, medicine, and business principles to try to deliver care in these really remote communities. And one of the first ways to do that, and I'm going to kind of date myself here, but we were using things like the Garmin tool, right, to try to figure out some solutions for, how do you get care to these really remote villages? And actually, for me, it was probably my first foray into this idea of tech-enabled care delivery, right? How can you use digital tools? So that's sort of, how I got into digital, I would say health in particular. But once I started practicing, I sort of finished residency and came back here to the San Francisco Bay Area to start my medical practice. And I went into, hospital medicine. I think in some ways it was by default, right? Just sort of being in Silicon Valley, this is sort of, 2014, 2015. There was just so much opportunity. I think that already some of the work around AI and digital health was really starting to sort of take shape. It was still very early, quite early actually. But there were some great companies working in that space. And so, I alongside my hospital practice, started working with a company back then called Lumiata, which, when I sort of think back on the company now, I sort of have this big smile that, wow, we were really trying to solve some big problems, because it was largely an AI company trying to do a variety of things in healthcare. So that was sort of my foray. I ended up sort of at these digital health startups, sort of one after the other. And then I, sort of ended up at the FDA because, like any person, once you start getting exposure to the tools, you start sort of seeing some of the limitations, right? You start seeing some of the snake oil, for example. And so, the FDA had this center of excellence, this digital health center of excellence that had been started around, I believe, 2013 or so. And I, ended up applying to work there. I thought, sort of the work they were trying to do around making sure that, if there are digital health tools that are in practice for clinicians, particularly AI tools, that they're safe and effective. I thought that was a great, mission to work towards. And so, yeah, I ended up at the FDA for 4 years, and only recently just left, as you know. Yeah.
Right. Actually, the way Lita and I met is I reached out to her because she was at the FDA, and our conference is going to be focusing on FDA-approved AI algorithms and the
Yeah.
evidence or studies behind those. So it was really important for me to connect with her. She was so kind to speak with me, and then that led to us doing this podcast today. Now, you've worn many hats, and I liked how you called it being a physician plus, because when we started practicing, and we've been practicing along a similar pathway in terms of time and type of practice, we just wanted to be a physician, but we didn't think about a plus. But it's so different now in 2025. I've worked with and still work with many resident physicians and mentor them. And more resident doctors are doing an extra couple of years in informatics. And you mentioned you were at Oregon, which is one of the truly great places in to train in that realm. And they are intentionally coming out of medical school and residency with this idea of physician plus. And so it wasn't a thing, so to speak, when we were training, but it certainly is now. And the advances in technology and AI and are, a big part of that. But with your multiple hats of physician, regulator, and investor, having seen it from every angle, when you were at the FDA, how did you separate, hype from like the really meaningful tools that people would use? I mean, more than anyone, probably you have really the greatest insight. And so I'm sure our audience would love to hear
Thanks.
your perspective on this.
I mean, it's a great question, right? So just in general, I think as a clinician, that's sort of always the first hat I've had on, and it probably always will be, right? Because I think that's just a great starting point, right? But specifically when it comes to digital health tools, and even more specifically when it comes to like AI products, I do sort of think about them from those three perspectives. I do think of them as sort of a regulator, right? So is it a tool that's already authorized by the FDA? And then I think about it like a clinician who's actually at the bedside with the patients. And then yes, and most recently through the lens of an investor too, right? Like in terms of the specific maybe business need that, this platform or this AI tool is really trying to address, right? So, the best way to probably sort of go through my own thinking is maybe just thinking of, for example, one of the, algorithms that's been developed, right? So let's say that as a company or as a startup, you are developing a subset algorithm for specifically maybe point of care in a clinical setting. If that algorithm is already FDA approved, I actually feel, pretty confident about that, mostly because now that I've been at the FDA 4+ years, I know that that product or that model for sepsis has, met the sort of rigorous FDA process that I'm familiar with, right? And it means that that AI probably can, with some substantiated backing, predict sepsis, right? But if it's not already authorized by the FDA, and you and I talked about this, there's already, I think 1100 plus, probably more now, that has already been authorized. I then, if I'm, for example, talking to a company or, talking to a developer, I get really laser focused on, sort of what the intended use of this algorithm is, what the context of use of that algorithm is. And then what is sort of their validation and performance metrics or performance numbers that they can speak of. So, in regulatory speak, we use the term intended use a lot, which basically refers to what the manufacturer will claim that their AI can do. And it really is foundational because, for example, a company that says, listen, we can predict sepsis into the future. I'm going to ask a lot of questions about exactly what that means, right? Because if you're predicting sepsis in an uncomplicated patient who maybe, happens to have, for example, oh, community-acquired pneumonia, and we can predict sepsis in this patient. That to me is fundamentally different than if you tell me our algorithm can predict sepsis on in a patient who has, community-acquired pneumonia, but happens to also be on dialysis and maybe they're getting chemo, right? Because, as clinicians, we know, right, there's sort of, different responses that a patient on chemo may not be able to mount that look like sepsis. And so for me, when I've talked to companies, these nuances really matter, because if you're starting to say, well, we can diagnose and we can treat and we can manage these things, through this algorithm, I'm going to ask a lot about your sort of validation claims and your performance metrics around that sepsis algorithm, right? And I don't want to sort of just see, those things just within sort of your development framework. I really want to see maybe if you even have some like real world clinical data. And then, then I sort of put on my, clinician hat and say, okay, so you've got this really great sepsis algorithm, or you're telling me you've got this really great sepsis algorithm. But, where data is really where I go to, right? Like, where is the data? How did you get it? What type of data is it, right? Is it EMR data? Is it claims data? Did you get it from maybe a symptom screener or a chat bot? And even more importantly, I would say, than sort of the type of data, I want to know a lot about how good that data was, right? So, for example, how long did you collect that data for? Was it complete? Is there a lot of variables that are missing, right? And this is really important, right? Because if you're using like a supervised model and you're feeding it, maybe different multimodal data sets, right? Maybe you're using imaging, maybe you're using, EMR claims, whatever, right? That multimodal data collection can end up being biased in a lot of ways, right? We've heard a lot about, sort of the problems with biased data, and especially if that data maybe does not capture what we just discussed, like an atypical presentation of sepsis or a complicated presentation of sepsis, or maybe it lacks really key sepsis indicators, right? Then that model might actually fail patients that actually really need it most, right? And I'll give you a really personal anecdote because this happened to me at the hospital. So, I was managing a patient with end-stage liver disease, and, the sort of the advisory comes up, right? And it says, oh, this patient has sepsis, start antibiotics, right? And, right, we've sort of all been there, right? Like the sort of click fatigue, I was like, nope, this patient does not have sepsis. Why, right? Because that model essentially was, picking up on really an atypical presentation, right, for end-stage renal disease, right? There were some biomarkers that are similar, right, in end-stage renal liver disease, excuse me, as is in sepsis, right? So maybe a low bicarb, maybe it was, a low sodium or something like that. But essentially, those were, what it told me to think about as I am, as the system was trying to tell me, this patient has sepsis. So, and I think what's essentially this alludes to is we sort of already know, like from the research, that AI is very good at these narrow specific tasks, right? But it basically cannot always generalize well, right? So it can predict sepsis maybe in that uncomplicated community-acquired pneumonia, but it may fail when it encounters more complicated or even just a di difficult or atypical presentation of sepsis. And so, as a clinician, if you're feeding me sort of, your AI model, I'm going to ask a lot about, your data sources. And especially if it's like a black box model, right? Not the one I just spoke about that gave me sort of clear reasons why I thought the patient with end-stage liver disease had sepsis, but maybe it's a black box model that actually can't explain to me why I thought that, right? I'm going to ask a lot of questions, right? Because at that point, right, that's really not clinical decision support, right? That's clinical risk. So before really I rely on an AI model to do my job, I ask a lot of questions. I want sort of those transparency Specifically, right, in AI, the terms are interpretability and explainability, right? Why did the AI system suggest, excuse me, this thing that it suggested, right? And you and I know, being sort of in the AI space, it's actually one of the hardest things you can do, right, is to explain and interpret the model's reasoning, right? I mean, right, and there's a mantra, right, in Silicon Valley, a lot of people use, right, we move fast and break things, right? Like, we don't do that in healthcare, right? That's not innovation, that's malpractice. So I'm pretty keen on asking a lot of questions about the data and the validity of the model. And sorry, that was a long-winded answer, but anyway, my final sort of hat, I think, as an investor, I ask a lot of questions as an investor about the market need, right? Are you actually solving a problem that somebody's willing to pay for? I feel like I've heard a lot of pitches in which there isn't a really clear understanding of the business need in healthcare. And I think, especially if you come from the tech world or if you come from sort of another industry, the complexity of healthcare is not very easy to unpack. So, for example, if you're trying to build a product, that product sort of business need looks very different if maybe you're primary care practice, maybe in a concierge model versus you're a primary care practice in a tertiary health system with 30 outpatient clinics, right? And maybe they're all in value-based care arrangements, right? So I ask a lot about that. And if I hear one more person say, healthcare is a $4.2 trillion market, and this is where we're gonna, inject ourselves into, but they don't get down to the nitty-gritty of who's gonna pay, what types of payments and incentives are there. Is there a CPT code for that, right? Is there a coverage policy for that? I try to interrogate a company's understanding of just the healthcare marketplace a lot because I do see a lot of companies making the mistake in thinking that healthcare economics is just a lot more straightforward than it is. So yeah, I just those are the three hats I think I generally look at companies through. Anyway.
Well, great. Thanks. I love that you gave the example of the sepsis model. I think that is by far the best example anyone could
It's very
give.
common.
And yeah, quite a few of our faculty that are in our organization are at Loma Linda, both in the pulmonary critical care department
Oh, I love it.
and in the cardiology department. And the head of pulmonary critical care, who's one of our members and leaders, he told me that he's been working on this sepsis problem for a very long time.
Well.
And he took the Harvard, or no, he actually took the MIT course, but I did the Harvard course and the MIT course to do some advanced training, just like you did in public health. I did it for AI. And
Yes.
he shared with me, his years of struggling with the sepsis problem. And we also have some researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison who have been working on the sepsis problem for a very long time in their pulmonary critical care department. And I'm from Chicago, Illinois, and it's the one that came out recently that the FDA approved was, I'm very proud to say, was designed heavily by researchers in Illinois, both at the University of Illinois and the Champaign campus, as well as the
Nice.
University of Chicago, and a startup that's here in Chicago that's based off of some of those faculty members. And what I learned from that New England Journal AI paper on sepsis, and this is the most current model that's is fabulous, but from an evidence-based perspective, which is really what our conference is going to focus on, the real trials, it is so much better and its performance and its area under the curves than the sepsis model that's built into Epic, which you had referred to. And everyone had access to the one in Epic, and when they did the head-to-head comparison and published this trial, it was amazing how good the newer version of AI applied to sepsis can be compared to one that just is a few years back and was deployed into the Epic system. So I really appreciate your comments there, and I love that you gave that personal example of a patient that you had. And I really think it highlights the things that we have to struggle with when we're deploying AI. Now, along those lines, where do AI developers get it wrong, so to speak, in healthcare? Like, what are the pitfalls, and what is your advice when you guide people to not get it wrong?
So I think, and I've worked with quite a number of developers and, top-notch people, a lot of them really mission-driven, wanting to fundamentally help, right? And improve healthcare. And I love that, right? Like that mission is so important. But, one of the ways that I think they think about healthcare, which is not, I think, right, is they think of healthcare as a product, right? So they will try to develop a product. Sometimes, unfortunately, and I've said this often, they will try to find then a problem, right? They'll try to develop a solution and then they'll try to find a problem to the solution, right? So I, never sort of a fan of, developing that way. But ultimately, I think this is what they get wrong. They think healthcare is a product and it's not, right? But healthcare is fundamentally a service line, right? And it's a service, so it means it's deeply driven by transparency and trust. And, I can't sort of pound that enough, right? And when I talk to founders and people in the space, and in my personal experience, right, good outcomes, even clinically, are very much then driven by those relationships, right? Sustained, ongoing, sort of not a single transaction, single algorithm that can spit out a diagnosis, right? I worked on a product once, just like you, and this was sort of early in my career, right? Where we did a lot of really good model building, right? We would get really great ROC numbers and PPV and sensitivity, specificity around things like stroke, for example. We would, we did a bunch of other diagnoses, but as a hospitalist, and you've seen this, right? Somebody who sees stroke a lot, small strokes, big strokes, sort of you name it, right? Just diagnosing somebody with a stroke is really a tiny fraction of the process required to make sure, right, that they go home functional, talking, and they don't have another stroke in 2 months, right? So I think, one of the challenges I think healthcare developers have is they sort of try to, engineer a solution in silo. But I think more and more developers should think about the clinicians, the doctors that they need, and they should be co-developing with those physicians and doctors, right? And in my opinion, if you're not doing that, or if you don't at least have like a forward deployed engineer who is on site and trying to figure something out with you, I think you're far behind. And I think you may make some good headway, but to sort of get it towards that entirety of the process that, I'm talking about getting a patient home and not having another stroke, that entire process, I think it requires developing with clinicians early on. So I think they get
Yeah,
that.
I think that's a brilliant pearl. So why I started this American College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine was to bring together clinicians and computer scientists and biomedical engineers to have a collaborative space where they could solve problems together. So it's really aligned so brilliantly with your pearl there about how to win in all of this. So I love that we are like-minded in this particular point, because I think really that is key. And often I'll talk to physicians that because they don't have advanced training or experience like you and I do, they feel very uncomfortable getting involved. And what they don't recognize is you don't have to be like a computer guru to be impactful as a physician. You just have to engage with a computer scientist and share with them the clinically relevant points because they haven't seen a patient. So, or if they have, they don't do it at our s level. I mean, they might have some hospital exposure, but you don't have to be like the most knowledgeable about computer science for to make an impact in AI as a doctor. You just have to show up and be involved and find and bring up the problems, like you had mentioned, solving the important problems and helping stay on point, knowing where they call it the pain points are, what needs to be solved. Like you said, it isn't just about one disease like stroke. It's where are the problems in stroke care from the beginning to the end, and how do we use AI as a tool to help the areas that we need help in? So, moving on, this past weekend, since we happened to be at a festival in our, we're in the Chicago suburbs, and there were some exhibits, and one of them was actually a mental health therapy clinic that was near where we live that was newly opened, and they just wanted to raise awareness that this is open. And the reason I bring it up is the name of their new clinic for mental health had something to do with the elephant in the room. They had like a logo with an elephant, and I was asking, and they're like, "Well, it's supposed to be the elephant in the room." And the reason I bring that up is, what's the elephant in the room, which means things that people aren't talking about that are important in AI and healthcare.
Yeah, that's a really great question. but I like that. I would like to see what that company is doing. Well, I'll give you three, or maybe a handful, but the three that sort of I have been, I feel like, trying to read up on a lot and thinking a lot, right? Because I think they're all connected. And I definitely think in general, as an AI community, we don't talk about them enough. And certainly in healthcare, probably we're not having the really meaningful conversations. So the first one, I think, is this idea of model collapse. I think we don't talk about that enough. And that leads into this other thing I've been sort of thinking a lot about. And, you know, it was just at the Stanford AI Med Symposium and speaking to a lawyer about it. We don't talk enough about this idea of AI that propagates error, right? So error propagation, what happens when a model is sort of, you know, there's an error in a model, but then it gets propagated through the system. And then lastly, I mean, this applies to all of AI, but I think we don't nearly talk enough about the carbon footprint of AI. So model collapse is this thing I've been reading about, which I actually think, you know, hopefully your listeners will be interested in this paper. But there's a really interesting one that came out of Oxford called The Curse of Recursion, right? So it's basically, this paper is basically describing what happens when training data on generated data, you know, makes models essentially forget the things that they have learned, right? And it's kind of been touted as digital inbreeding, essentially a process where generative models like large language models start training on outputs from other generative models, right? So as you can imagine, over time, the system is no longer grounded in real human-generated data. It's just kind of learning from its own reflection. And that's a problem because it can then start to misperceive, right, its own reality. Right. So what happens is you get these models that sound really confident, for example, but they're still off, right? And you know, this paper kind of describes that this idea of model collapse starts to creep in slowly, and it may start to creep in again across generations of models, where you start to reinforce, you know, maybe really subtle errors, hallucinations, for example, or biases, right? So that is something that, you know, then has led me to think a lot about this idea of error propagation, right? So what happens in healthcare if modeling mistakes don't just stay in the model, right? And they compound through like different decision-making layers, for example, where one flawed prediction can sort of ripple through an entire system. And if we don't have the systems in place to audit and evaluate it continuously, you know, are we still then just baking those errors and calling it progress, right? So if we think about like, okay, maybe let's not use sepsis again because I don't want to keep bad mouthing sepsis. We have a lot of problems in sepsis and we need to fix them. But, you know, say you have a model that maybe predicts MI, right? Heart attack, right? And the model is maybe trained on a retrospective data from a system where the majority of maybe women of color, for example, are underdiagnosed because they present with atypical symptoms, right? So this kind of idea of the atypical presentation again, right? So, what happens is you build this model and the AI starts to learn to underweight atypical symptoms. So, I'm talking about things like, jaw pain, maybe fatigue, maybe, nausea, for example, right? Things you and I have seen in women that can present as a heart attack, but are not your sort of your standard typical symptoms, right? And then, you're in the hospital, Mel, or I'm in the hospital, and a 52-year-old woman comes in with sort of these atypical symptoms. And we're using this AI tool. And the AI tool says, well, this woman is low risk for MI, right? And we decide to discharge her. We don't do sort of a, million-dollar workup, and she goes home, and, she may or may not suffer a cardiac arrest, 12 hours later. So we have to remember that this AI system is part of a continuous learning loop, right? So what it's using post-evaluation data that we input into our hospital's, records somehow to refine the predictions for the next cycle of learning, right? And now because the model labels, this type of a presentation as non-MI, it incorporates that non-MI label into its sort of future training, right? And so, sort of operationally now, I think this tool is rolled out across a health system with multiple affiliated, clinics and hospitals. And over time, more and more women with sort of these atypical symptoms are misclassified and undertreated, right? And because these patients were essentially misdiagnosed, right, not followed up on, there's really, again, no ground truth fed back into the system, right? So there's real harm not only in misclassifying these atypical cases and misclassifying sort of that one person, but that sort of corpus of knowledge for atypical symptoms is never made whole, right? We haven't maybe built in the governance or the correction for that error propagation for it to become whole. So that concerns me a lot, right? Because that means, that is fundamentally different, for example, than me missing a case of MI on a patient. That is something that concerns me. And I think the answer to that might be this idea of better AI governance tools, right? Like health systems. And I know there are some health systems already developing protocols around that. I know sort of CHAI, which is one of the big, organizations now that sort of developed around this concept. They're doing some things around model cards and sort of other governance structures that I think is really important. So, and then the last one, sort of, I told you I was, going to sort of go outside of healthcare, but I think it's so fundamentally important, is the carbon footprint, right? We all know, like, models, especially models that get retrained frequently, are really, energy intensive, right? So I think the stat I looked at before, we had this call, was that it takes essentially 500 metric tons, which is the energy equivalent of 50 households in the United States, to train something like GPT-3. I mean, that's a ton, right? So I think it's a real sustainability issue. And in healthcare, you know this, I know this, we're already struggling with equity. We're already struggling with resource allocation. So we have to, I think, ask ourselves, are we building systems that are efficient, responsible, fair? And I think we need to have deep conversations about these trade-offs, right? Like, what does it mean to build a model that actually is really fit for purpose and does something and not just sort of performative, right? I think if we're not careful, we're going to increasingly build these systems that are in, yes, intelligent, but maybe confidently wrong, right? And really cool and interesting, but environmentally unstable. And then, maybe just, clinically harmful too. So I think about these things a lot in terms of, just maybe the overall, the things people are not thinking about very much.
No, I love that you mentioned the global impact, especially with your training in your in public health from Harvard. And many people have been concerned, as you have, about the impact that it'll have, on the environment and on the world in that regard. So I really think that highlighting that is a really good point. I just want to talk for a moment about these FDA algorithms and the ones that are, let's say, the best, maybe not the best, but the use cases that are really impactful. So for sure, sepsis is, because one in every three hospital deaths are from sepsis. What other use cases for me that are like going to be truly amazing are training a model to look at an EKG and predict things that are beyond just reading the EKG, and then training the model to look at a retinal photograph, but to see beyond the eye image to detect, say, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, cardiovascular disease, renal disease. But, we talked at the beginning that there's o over 1,000 of these approved algorithms. Other than the sepsis one, which one or two are like the most impactful for you as a practicing physician?
Oh gosh. I love that question because sometimes, like I said, when I worked sort of with companies and they're like, well, we want to diagnose, we want to diagnose. And I kind of think I'm like, is the hardest part of my day diagnosing? Right? I'm like, I don't think so, right? Like I don't think that generally that's the case. I do think that there is quite a bit of value. And actually, I had a really good conversation recently. I think one of the most exciting use cases for AI in healthcare in general for me, and maybe this has something to do with the fact that I've, been in global health and been in places like Afghanistan and India. I think AI is going to have a profound impact on access and improving access to care in traditionally low resource settings, and that doesn't just mean, Afghanistan or India. It really means even, the rural United States, right? Where we have huge physician shortage areas, right? I used to practice in northern Michigan and, I was the only doctor on call for I don't know how many miles, right? So I think we've got, a real opportunity to use AI for diagnostics, for example, to improve, sort of healthcare in these areas. So to me, that's really the most exciting is using AI to improve the equitable allocation of healthcare and healthcare resources in this country. Am I really excited about one specific sort of use case in terms of AI? I think, and this is not going to be something that I think may necessarily be in FDA territory, even though, sort of a lot of the AI tools I saw at the FDA were really interesting. In particular, I think, AI tools that really improve the clinical workflow. You and I know, right? When we see patients, there are so many things outside of diagnosis that determine the outcome for that patient, right? Everything from social determinants of health to, comorbidities to insurance status to, whether they have a home and can make it to a dialysis appointment next week, right? So there's all of these operational and clinical workflow aspects that I am excited for in terms of AI, and not really even just AI in general, but like agentic AI, right? The idea that we can use AI to actually accomplish specific repetitive tasks that don't need, that don't necessarily need a doctor or a nurse to do them, but we need to get them done so we can sort of move people along, in their care journey. I think that's the thing I get most excited about, and as we apply that to especially to communities that don't have the sort of resources, for example, to see a highly trained, specialist, for example. I think if we can use AI to expand on the expertise of folks and upskill folks, I think these are all going to be really great use cases.
Yeah, when I speak about AI at major conferences, the thing I always tell the audience I'm most excited about are those deployments of AI, like the example of diabetic retinopathy screening being deployed in rural India and Thailand. What excites me in the way that you described isn't necessarily the specific ex use case, but the fact that we can provide care to those who otherwise wouldn't have access to care. That's what like really excites me and wants me to push to do this work that you and I are doing, is to be difference makers worldwide.
100%. Yeah,
And
100%.
clearly you were influenced by the training in global health in that, and I was so inspired hearing the stories of Lily Pang at Google deploying for the last decade into rural India and Thailand. That kind of like big win success story is what really excites me as well. So it's so amazing how aligned we are in the in our vision of what's important in AI and medicine. It's such a pleasure chatting you up with you about this. So as we start to close, often people are asked to kind of look into the future, which I hate to ask you that because, Jeff Hinton predicted stuff and then everybody criticizes him for being wrong. So without saying anything about the number of years into the future, just what do you see the direction we're headed soon? Let's just say that.
I mean, I think it kind of sort of on the heels of what I just discussed, I am excited about a few specific sort of technology components embedded with AI, right? So I had a really great call today with a company, and I hope they don't mind that I use their name, but I'm sure they won't. It's a startup called Nependa, and they are building remote patient monitoring tools. So essentially a small tool of that captures continuous vital signs from, neonates, right? People like babies in areas in Africa. Particularly, they're working in Kenya, right? And so they're using a combination of this hardware that they have built plus the software that they have embedded, at using sort of AI and whatnot to essentially help upskill and optimize the one nurse to 250 baby ratio in these hospitals, right? So imagine the impact that sort of these technologies can have if, again, because we've got, the sustained, continuous ways to capture data, and then we've got the sort of intelligence and computational powers at our disposal to really be able to deliver care in a way that we've never done before. That gets me really excited. Sometimes I refer to it as telehealth 2.0, right? Because I think we're sort of familiar with this concept of telehealth, but what happens when you can sort of, merge sort of all of the information and the insights and the intelligence with the actual care by a physician or a clinician or a community health worker or a village health worker, right? I get really excited about leveraging sort of this, the hardware and the software to expand global access to care, right? I mean, I'm sure you heard, right? We just most recently had the first transcontinental robotic surgery to remove prostate cancer, performed on a man in Angola by a physician from Advent Health in Florida, right? And the first sort of AI plus remote robotic throat surgery was done in China. So I think we're sort of at the cusp of things to come. And I think what it'll look like in 10-ish years, I think AI will be ubiquitous in healthcare, right? I think the agents and the co-pilots that I was talking about earlier for many of sort of, again, the specific tasks, I think they will be there. And what I hope that means for our country and sort of in general is that these will create then efficiencies in healthcare that'll offset to some degree the sort of ballooning cost of care in this country, right? My hope is that it'll just mean those efficiencies will take us out from this terrible cycle that we've been in of high cost and poor outcomes, right? And then the other thing I think it means for us in the next 10 years is that Healthcare will hopefully be really deeply personalized, right? So whether it's the wearables or the RPM tools, or whether it's precision sort of genomics and precision medicine, right? And that's what precision means, right? Is that we've got now sort of enough data to say something very specific, right? And that means that hopefully we're also living in a healthcare paradigm where we're anticipating and understanding prevention a lot more, right? And we're really starting to bend the curve on these healthcare outcomes, right? I think that's where I see, I'm, as you can see, a tech optimist in that sense. So that's where I see things sort of going.
Great. Well, our time is just about up, but I wanted to just throw something non-AI related. So when I do these podcasts, it's from my library. And to my side here, you may notice there's a bookshelf on which there are leather-bound books that are gilded. They're the highest craftsmanship made here in the
Love
USA. But what's interesting is not a one of them is a medical book. Each one
it.
is one of the greatest works of literature ever written, times 100. And the reason I bring it up is as I prepared for the podcast, I looked through your LinkedIn CV. And as I scrolled to the very, very earliest thing I could find, because I'm doing my due diligence as an interviewer, I learned in a delightful way that your degree in undergrad was in literature. And I thought, just what are, I really feel that literature is such an important piece in developing humanism in the physician. But I'm curious, we can be off topic now that we're done, but we're still recording. Do you have anything you want to say to the listeners about literature and how it impacted you as a physician?
Oh, what a great question. And yes, you know, it's funny you look that up because not a lot of people know that about my background. And oh boy, am I so glad I did, right? I actually had my best friend convinced, I started out as a molecular and cell biology major, and my best friend convinced me to go into English lit. And I am so glad I did. And I went to Berkeley, and so Berkeley has one of the best English departments. But I will tell you, and I heard something recently that actually made me, you know, sort of think a lot about this in the context of, you know, how I, you know, motivate my own children, for example. But, you know, we are sort of in an era of AI where a lot of jobs will get replaced, right? I think that's scary, right? I think that's very scary. And more so that even not, right? I'm hearing talk about how, you know, no one needs to learn to code anymore, right? The AI is coding better than, right? So, you know, 10 years ago, we were telling maybe our kids, oh, you got to learn to code. It's like the new reading. That turns out that may not be the case anymore, right? But I think one thing that AI will likely not be able to replace as much is communication. And so for me, as an English major, I didn't think that's what I was learning. I ended up switching partly because I just love to read so much. I had a really great high school English teacher too. So, you know, shout out to high school teachers. But, you know, what I learned, I think more than anything, is how to communicate. And that communication has been profoundly important in my career. And it has been profoundly important with my patients, as you can imagine. And it's, you know, it's the best. Major in English, read good books, you know, opens the world to you. So I'm glad to see all of those up there. And that is wonderful that none of them are science books. Some of mine are.
Yeah. So both you and I are a testament to the value of a liberal arts
What
education.
did you study? Did you study English too?
Well, no, I did
Liberal arts.
biology, biological sciences, and chemistry at Northwestern, but I really emphasized during my 4 years the well-rounded liberal arts education. The whole Renaissance person concept, and have all and have continued to enjoy great literature, and have seen how some of the really great literature is actually, even though it's fiction, it's some of it's written by physicians. Like for example, Arthur Conan Doyle was a physician. Many of the great authors are have also were actually physicians, or their stories are often about a physician
Yeah.
and their relationship with their family and their patients. And so
Yeah.
I really think that it makes you a better, like you said, communicator, makes you more compassionate and
I
humanistic.
agree.
And I actually was talking to a patient the other day who said, that, his doctor was great. He saw a specialist for a really difficult problem. But the thing he liked the most about the visit wasn't the diagnostic skill, even though he was seeing one of the best here in Chicago. It was the fact that that physician took the time, even though we're all pressured, as you well know, took the time to have a conversation about something personal, something humanistic, personal that had nothing to do with the medical problem. So there's the medical care, but that's also building that doctor-patient relationship. And I really do the same. I go out of my way to, even if it puts me behind in the time slot, spend some portion of that visit, even if it's a few minutes, chatting about something personal that has nothing to do with the diagnosis, why they're there. And that's where the magic happens. And just thought that, given how everything has evolved with digital and AI medicine, that just making a plug for, just asking them about their family, asking them
Well,
about
and
their
hopefully that's what
personal
happens, right?
interests.
And hopefully that's
And
what happens, right?
oftentimes some of the major clues that give you an answer aren't the straight questions you ask, but knowing about them and their family and their situation and will often allow you to overcome some of those barriers to care, like you were talking about earlier. Well, Lita, it is
Absolutely.
just a joy to speak with you. I absolutely loved our conversation. I hope
I did too.
the listeners got a lot of great pearls, which I certainly did, from somebody who has been doing this for a significant amount of time before the hype, and someone who could clearly distinguish the hype from something that's meaningful and impactful. So, really great chatting with you.
And you as well.
Hope we stay connected in the years
We
ahead, and wishing you great success in the next endeavors in AI and
Thank
medicine.
you.
So
Thank
thank
you
you for
so
being on
much.
the
Thank you for
podcast.
having me.
Okay,
This was really great.
bye.
If you enjoyed what you heard here today, consider becoming a member of our professional society by going to www.americancollegeaim.org and click join. Also, don't forget to save the dates. September 19th and 20th, 2025, we'll be having our first ever scientific session at McCormick Place right here in Chicago. Go to our website to register to attend the conference. We hope to see you all live in Chicago, and we look forward to having you tune in to our next podcast on Melvin Monday here on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube.